right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And our show today is, as usual, packed. And we're going to have to move through it as just, I don't know, it's going to be like we're greased and moving through this thing, man. Because we got so much to talk about. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Marilyn McMahon, an attorney and executive director of the California Prison Focus. And Marilyn's joining us to give an update on the prisoner hunger strike and where things are at, what's going on inside the walls and outside the walls in terms of the support that's been growing for the strike, where things stand and where are they going to go now. And before that, we'll be talking with Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. We're going to be talking with her about the U.S. hypocrisy on the laws of war and why any attack on Syria is going to be yet another international crime of the Obama regime. All right? The Obama regime and his administration, his henchmen, his gang. All right? Opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show David Swanson. I think this is the first time David's been on the show, and I'm really pleased to welcome him here. He's an author, journalist, host of Talk Nation Radio, and he also has the website warisacrime.org. And David's going to be talking with us about what the hell's going on in Syria, the lies that are being used to justify what seems to be shaping up as another huge assault on humanity and concentrated in the Middle East and on Syria this time. And as we go to press, there is, in fact, and everybody knows this, there's a growing danger of a direct U.S. military attack on Syria, and it's being framed as a surgical strike using planes and or cruise missiles. The U.S. Secretary of Defense, and boy, you got to put that one in quotes, huh? The U.S. Secretary of Defense, Hagel, announced that the U.S. military is ready to go if ordered to attack Syria. Well, you know what? Only worse suffering and horrors can result from a U.S. attack on Syria. Let's just be straight and upfront about that. Only worse suffering and horrors can come out of a U.S. attack on Syria. And these attacks have got to be opposed with determined political protest and a clear-eyed understanding of how they would make the situation worse. And to talk with us about all that is David Swanson. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, wonderful to be here.
Good. Well, let's jump into this, man. You wrote an article recently that I thought was extremely important. Well, you've written a number of them that I thought were really good in terms of really hitting right back at what's going on with this assault on Syria and a broader, bigger picture involved in all this. But you framed it around the question of the lies that are being used to justify this. And in particular, I wanted you to talk in general about that, but I also wanted to talk about how the media has contributed to this in general. The media lies that truth has somehow disappeared, and once again, reality is being manufactured as we go along.
Well, I'm glad you're going to have Marjorie Cohn on. She's wonderful, and this will be illegal. War is illegal. It's illegal to try to overthrow a government. It's illegal to send missiles into somebody's cities. But it's also immoral. It's going to be catastrophic. It's going to be counterproductive on its own terms. There's not any proposal to resolve the war or end the war. This is a proposal to keep the war going and to escalate the violence and destruction by killing people with missiles. Raytheon, you know, their stock's up 20% the past 2 days. They're loving it, but the rest of us are against this. And so this will be another war in the name of democracy and human rights against the overwhelming opinion of the people in this so-called democracy. And Parliament yesterday stood up to their prime minister and voted no on a war for the first time since they decided to surrender to the colonists back in our revolution. And Congress is on vacation and staying there. I just got in the door this second to get on the phone with you from visiting my congressman's office here in rural Virginia, one of these Republicans who has signed on to a letter asking the president if he could please consult with Congress before starting another war. And we asked him to do a little bit more than that. Cut off the money. Tell Speaker Boehner to bring Congress back. Parliament came back. Oppose the war. We don't want a war if Congress authorizes it. We want opposition to this war. We'll see what response, if any, we get out of him.
Well, you know, one of the things that has been used to and I think it is really important in terms of what the response of people is, you know, you think about this. This is coming on the in the midst of a whole season where so many things that people thought never could have happened have happened, you know, starting with the Trayvon Martin, the trial of Zimmerman for the murder of Trayvon Martin and his being let off, the spying, the assault on, you know, what Edward Snowden revealed and the assault on him, Chelsea Manning being sentenced for revealing the war crimes that the U.S. has committed in Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, you think about all this and people now again are confronted with something that's really pretty horrendous, where the U.S. is talking about, look, They're using chemical weapons, and damn it, they have to be opposed. This is against all the laws of humanity. And yet, at the same time, you know, you're standing there, and it's almost like they're grinning in this Orwellian-type thing where they're sort of like, yeah, and you know that we've done it too, right? You know, and it's, I think there's this, the point you made about lies. This is really a time of the Orwellian, you know, the Orwellian phrases are, and speaking and thinking is on the rise in terms, in a certain sense, wouldn't you say?
I couldn't agree more. You know, the United States is propping up and arming brutal governments in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Yemen, in Egypt now, in Israel, of course, and has, of course, itself used and possesses chemical weapons, used napalm and white phosphorus as weapons in Iraq, uses depleted uranium and cluster bombs, is shipping cluster bombs off to Saudi Arabia as we speak, and is proposing to be the world's policeman and send in missiles to punish people because their government used chemical weapons. Never mind that it risks dramatically escalating a war and killing many more people. You know, we don't just have a government now that has to promise Russia we won't torture or murder a whistleblower if he's returned here. We have a situation in which Russia and now the United Kingdom and who knows who else are going to use the United Nations, if possible, to stop the United States from launching another illegal war. It's hard to imagine how you go lower than this. But the most shocking thing, the thing that I don't think we imagined before, is the extent to which President Obama gets away with opposing his own policies. And this is what the media is doing to us, is presenting President Obama as this reluctant warrior who's against war, even while his subordinates at his command are moving ships and troops into position to launch another war.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's something about that, too, though. You got to think about this. This cat has, you know, think about what he's done in the last, you know, since he's been elected. Think about what he's done. I mean, how many wars have gone on? How many people have been killed? How many, all these things, that the drone attacks. I mean, you know, no one, I don't think anyone should be able to say Obama without saying drones, you know, because there's like, you look at the just the heartless inhumanity and the criminal character of these drone attacks. And, you know, whether it's the stuff that's going on with Waziristan or in Yemen, all these things, hundreds of people, thousands of people killed by these things. And it's just, and he sits there. And as someone once said, that he watches the equivalent of snuff films with Nancy Pelosi as they review the result of the drone attacks. And this is, so when you're talking about he goes against his own policies, I think there's that sort of thing of like, you know, well, no, I'm not going to do anything to you. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm telling you the truth. But actually, and right behind him and everything else, everything he's about is about actually doing the exact opposite.
That's right, including expanding presidential powers beyond Bush and Cheney's wildest dreams, to the point where we now long for a president who would bother to lie to Congress before he launches wars. You know, in Libya and now with Syria, you know, you don't even get that. We don't even know where all the wars are. I was out on the street here in Charlottesville, Virginia yesterday protesting this looming attack, and most people who bothered to stop and talk to us said, now which attack, which country? There are so many now. They can't keep them all straight because we have these drone wars in a dozen nations. We have special forces that aren't special anymore in some 70 or 80 nations. We have the CIA launching its own wars using drones. We saw their budget now at $14 billion yesterday. We have a new Asian Navy headquarters for the U.S. Navy opening yesterday in South Korea, more bases being constructed, more countries with U.S. military presence around the world, a larger military, and the occupation of Afghanistan, twice the size now as what it was when we elected Obama, and everybody thinks it's over or quote-unquote ending. And President Obama gets away with this in a way that President Bush never, ever possibly could have. If the New York Times had reported that President Bush was going through a list of men, women, and children on Tuesdays to pick which ones to kill, we would have had a revolution.
You know, yeah, boy, do we need one. I'll tell you, here's the thing is, you know, you think about this too, and I was thinking about that because some of the things that I was preparing to talk with you, you know, some of the things that I saw that actually were things that I didn't realize at first. You know, the idea that, for instance, around the Doctors Without Borders report on the civilian deaths related to exposures to chemical agents, and the way that was twisted and consciously lied about by Obama's people, you know, and all this stuff about, you know, because they said that this exposure what the Doctors Without Borders reported. They said that the exposure to chemical agents is enough to justify war. But the truth is actually the toxins that the Doctors Without Borders found were never identified. They never said who actually did it. And then the number of deaths were greatly exaggerated by the U.S., who chose to say what their, the different band of rebels that they identify with over there said, well, there were thousands killed, and the Doctors Without Borders said there were like 300, and there's all this stuff that's being built up, and you get that same thing in terms of the treatment of the UN inspection team. I mean, it's sort of like, yeah, keep yapping and keep walking, get the hell out of there, we got business to take care of, I mean, that's the kind of thing.
Yeah, we've gotten used to these human rights groups sort of feeding the war machine, but this organization, Doctors Without Borders, has actually come out with a statement and said, we do not want anything we reported used as a justification for war. It isn't. It cannot be used as such, and we don't want it done in our name. And that's greatly to their credit. We don't know, and experts who have looked at it don't know what chemicals, if any, were used and by whom and with what authority, but we do know that regardless of what was done, regardless of whether Bashar Assad went out there and personally murdered people with gas, there is no justification for a war that's going to make things worse for the people of Syria. And the people of Syria, there's no scientific polling, but every report suggests the people of Syria overwhelmingly against foreign bombing, regardless of what they think of their government.
Mm-hmm. It's a very heavy point. I'd like you to explore a little bit. First, let me tell people, I'm getting so into the conversation, I forget to identify who you are. We're talking with David Swanson, author, journalist, and host of Talk Nation Radio, and he also is on the site warisacrime.org. David, tell me this, because I think that's an extremely important stand that you took, that even if Syria had used chemical weapons, that this should not be an excuse or a justification for launching an attack against Syria. Let's dig a little deeper into that.
Well, if it were, there would be an excuse for bombing Washington because the United States military uses chemical weapons, uses other internationally sanctioned weapons, uses depleted uranium and cluster bombs, as well as napalm and white phosphorus. But, killing people is killing people. And both sides in this war have been seriously accused of using chemical weapons, whether any of those accusations are proved true or not. And both sides in this war have viciously killed people. I mean, you can go and watch videos of Syrian rebels cutting a man's heart and liver out and eating it. This is not a crusade for human rights and democracy. This is putting the United States military on the same side as al-Qaeda, on the same side as people with absolutely no interest in promoting human rights, which is not an interest that the U.S. government has itself, if you look at its policy, including across that region. And we have an alternative, this idea that you can do nothing or bomb Syria into the sort of disaster that Iraq or Libya is just bogus. You're not going to end the war by bombing. You're going to prolong it. The way to end the war is to pressure Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and Turkey on the one hand, and Russia and Iran on the other hand, to stop arming both sides. Demand a ceasefire. Let tempers cool. Settle things down and get that peace conference in Geneva, which has been blocked by the Syrian rebels, not the Syrian government. Get everybody to that table. You'll be able to do it if Russia and Iran insist on it, just as you've been able to get the UN inspectors in the first place, and start talking about ending the war, which, you just don't end wars by escalating them. This is a myth that comes out of the surge in Iraq and the surge in Afghanistan. You end wars by ending them, and this has always been an available option.
Well, let me ask you this, David, because, one of the things, I was going to invite Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait to come on to talk about this as well, but she can't make it. And I wanted you to talk about this somewhat. There is an importance. When I was reading the intro to this, I was thinking about, the point that only the worst horror can come of any kind of assault on Syria. At the same time, the question comes up of the need and the responsibility of people, particularly to get into the streets, the need and responsibility of people to resist what's happening. Because I think generally around the world, people might look, the growing hatred for not just this country and its regime, but there's also a sense of what the hell are the people doing here? And what do you think about this point about resistance is needed, it's really needed more than ever before, and it must be done in order to stop this war effort?
Well, I know and like Deborah Sweet, and I would agree with her when she came on and said that, and I certainly agree with you. There is no question. And people think that activism is futile, that it does no good, because the successes are not advertised. You have to go and read the politicians' memoirs from years later, as you can do with George W. Bush now, to see the impact that the peace movement was having, because they won't tell you about it. They will pretend to ignore you. But the fact is that what has kept the United States out of Syria, or Iran for that matter, thus far, is the movement that we had from 2003 to 2006 or so against the war in Iraq, and the public awareness of the lies and deceptions and the disaster that was supposed to be a cakewalk. And in fact, when the United States military went into Afghanistan, you had a majority of Americans in support of that. And then a year and a half later, and from that point forward, saying, no, no, never should have done that. With Iraq, same story. Here with Syria, you have a strong majority against it from the beginning. This is what we always wished we could have. This is why I wrote a book a few years ago called War is a Lie, in attempt to educate people about war lies so that we could oppose a war before it started this time. Well, here we are, and we've got it, and we've got Republicans willing to oppose war, or at least to pretend to oppose war, and some section of the Democrats still opposed to war. We have a huge potential to build a movement against wars, and in particular against the war in Syria. And you know, we're not that far behind England. Our brothers and sisters over there got their parliament to stand up and do the right thing yesterday. We have that possibility, and we have it for bizarre partisan reasons and Republicans who hate Obama because he's African and so forth. But we need to end wars no matter how we end wars. And if we can get a majority in Congress to stand up and do it because we compel them to, I don't care if two-thirds of them are Republican. I don't care if they're Martians. I don't care if they hate black people. I want them to prevent a war. And, you know, we need people in the streets pushing their local governments, pushing organizations, pushing activist groups, and pushing Congress until we stop this thing.
Well, you know, one thing I would ask you, and I think this will probably be towards the end of the questions, but, you know, there is a point to this thing of, like, even just sort of, if you think about what is bringing these wars on, what's operating there? What is it that actually is being, why is the U.S. doing stuff like this? And even I'd raise a question to you. For instance, I was thinking about Libya, you know, and the way that they intervened in Libya. And a lot of what they couch it in is the idea that somehow they're moving to protect human rights. And you know, they circumvented the U.N. in relation to Afghanistan. They, you know, there was an outcry in Congress in the beginning about about various wars, and then suddenly, but everybody goes along at a certain point. And even, you know, the question of, you know, what happens in Britain and whether it happens. I mean, it was, again, that was 13 people that gave them that vote. But then there's, you know, will they act unilaterally? I mean, this is, you know, Obama has done that before, acted unilaterally in order to, and frankly, even, you know, this whole idea of, it's interesting. I was looking at thinking about what's been going on with the drone attacks and the fact that Congress and everyone else has, you know, has sat there and sort of meekly and mildly gone along with the expression of U.S. imperial savagery in relation to the drone attacks or in relation to the assault on Libya. And they constantly make excuses to circumvent things and get things done because they have bigger strategic interests at stake.
Well, you know, there's everybody wants to find the one secret reason behind the wars, and I don't think there is one. I think there are many. I think there's irrational drives for power and machismo and the desire to maintain face and credibility by killing some people as if that makes you somehow credible. There's the profit interests and the corruption of our government. Raytheon is clearly eager to have those $3 million missiles shot because then they get to make more $3 million missiles. The interventions, yes, are presented as humanitarian. They just don't benefit humanity. And the charade in Libya, where there was this pretense that people needed to be saved, and you got a UN resolution, and then you went and pretended to save those people, and immediately turned it into a U.S.-NATO war to overthrow a government, and bombed until you overthrew that government, has got a number of people in this country upset and cynical and wary of another war, but has also got nations like Russia unwilling to permit another UN resolution. So you have Russia and the United Kingdom and others that are not going to go along. So this is going to have to be without the United Nations. It's going to probably have to be, or it's going to be because of the timing, without Congress. And this is they're openly pointing to the model of President Clinton's bombing of Kosovo, which went against the will of Congress and the Constitution. They're openly suggesting that because that was done, somehow that's okay to do. And yes, Congress members want to stand by the side and pretend they're not involved, pretend they tried to do something, and then blame the president, but not take any of the blame themselves. We need to make clear to them today, without a moment's delay, that we are blaming them for refusing to go back to Washington and hold a vote and cut off the money and prevent the war. People can go to rootsaction.org, where I work, and any number of other sites to communicate by email, but, you know, get in the streets as well.
All right, David, I want to thank you very much, and I would just add one little point, which I think is worth all everyone considering, is that, you know, really, when one thing I really unite with in what you were saying is that the people themselves have got to stop looking up and acting as pressure groups and more looking at they're going to stop the war. No matter what it takes, they're going to stop the war, and they're going to be out mounting resistance in the streets and in all kinds of ways to stop that, and depending on ourselves, not anyone else. So, David, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Right on. Thank you.
Okay, take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with David Swanson, author, journalist, and host of Talk Nation Radio. We're going to take a quick break and be right back to speak with Marjorie Cohn about the hypocrisy involved in what the U.S. is threatening in Syria. So stay tuned.
I'm on a war tour with Obama, my man. It never matters where I go, yo, there I am. I'm on a war tour with a gun in my hand, bombing each and every land, cause I'm there I can. This war is never ending, let's stop pretending. This government keeps its troops everywhere it sends them, forever. Never even occupy another land. Since World War II, they still got troops in Japan, man. And they plan to keep them there for eternity. 65 years later, still got soldiers left in Germany. It's USA, hey, that's how they do ya. Since 1898, they're still a Navy base in Cuba. Guantanamo. Yeah, no matter where we go, they adore us, cause we always bring McDonald's with us, plus a couple models with us. What's the problem with us? Iraq, Afghan, Libyan, what? Child killing, bomb dropping, tree chopping, huh? Iraq, Afghan, Libyan, what? Child killing, bomb dropping, tree chopping, huh? I'm on a war tour with Obama, my man. It never matters where I go, yo, there I
That's right, a war tour with Obama, my man. There you go. And that's Sunrise Above. All right, Sunrise Above. And the song is Obamba. Okay, that's what he is, Obama. Obama, all right? Joining us now to talk about the U.S. hypocrisy on the laws of war is Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and deputy secretary general of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. And she's got a hell of a viewpoint expressed in almost everything I've read of hers. And don't ask me why I said almost, that just came out. But especially in this most recent article that I saw on consortiumnews.com. And the article was U.S. Hypocrisy on Laws of War. And it's in relation to what's going on in Syria, what's being threatened in Syria. Marjorie, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Michael.
Yeah, good to have you back. Okay.
Good to be back.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this right away. There's something Orwellian that's going on about launching a military assault that's going to kill many, many civilians in order to show that killing civilians is wrong. Let's just kick this around because I remember reading your book on torture and the sort of the Orwellian gist of things and how, you know, up is down and right, wrong justifies right, and whatever, right justifies wrong, whatever this thing is right or is wrong or whatever it is. There's all kinds of things that are coming out that are just like, not just deceptive, but I mean, just Orwellian. I can't think of any other way to explain it. It's just, and said with straight faces.
Well, you know, Michael, it's interesting because yesterday Hans Blix published an article in The Guardian, and he was the head of the weapons inspectors, the UN weapons inspectors on MOVIC, who were looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq before Bush said, you better get out, we're going to start bombing. And this is really, really interesting what Hans Blix says. He's not a radical. He says, And what is the moral weight of the condemnation by nuclear weapons states of the use of gas as a serious war crime when they themselves will not accept a norm that would criminalize any first use of their own nuclear weapons? I nobody says it better than that, the hypocrisy. I mean, when I read that, I was really stopped in my tracks. But what would happen if the United States, and it looks like the United States, maybe France is going to join the UK, as David was discussing with you, has said no. But an attack on Syria would violate international law. There's no way around it. It would violate the UN Charter, which mandates that countries settle their disputes peacefully. It makes it illegal for any country to use force or threaten to use force against another country. It prohibits intervention in any internal or domestic dispute in another country. The only time the UN Charter allows the use of military force is when the Security Council approves it, and it certainly has not done that here, or in self-defense. And certainly Syria has not attacked the United States or France or any other country, and this would not constitute self-defense. The hypocrisy of it, when the Obama says, well, there's a red line, and once they cross that red line, assuming that Assad even used the chemical weapons, and the State Department has admitted they don't know who used them. It could be the opposition, even though the opposition is not united at all. And we don't know. In fact, the Carla Del Ponte from the UN documented that opposition forces used gas a few months ago. So we don't know who it is. But even assuming we know who it is, it's hypocritical for the United States to be complaining about this. First of all, when Obama is killing people with drones, suspected militants, lots of civilians, no trial, just killing them, as if it's worse to kill people with chemicals than with drones. And also, if you look at the United States history of using chemical agents and supporting countries that use chemical agents, for example, supporting Saddam Hussein when he was using chemical weapons against Iran, according to Foreign Policy, again, not a radical publication, Foreign Policy said the United States applied a cold calculus three decades ago to Hussein's widespread use of chemical weapons against his enemies and his own people. The Reagan administration decided that it was better to let the attacks continue if they might turn the tide of the war, and even if they were discovered, the CIA wagered that international outrage and condemnation would be muted. In addition, the United States used cluster bombs, depleted uranium and white phosphorus gas in Iraq and Afghanistan. Cluster bomb canisters have tiny bomblets which spread over a large area. They sometimes don't explode, and they're picked up by children because they look like Coke cans, and they explode and kill them or seriously injure them. Depleted uranium weapons spread radiation over vast areas of land, and in Iraq, there's been a sharp increase in leukemia and birth defects, probably from depleted uranium. White phosphorus gas burns to the bone. And we use that in Iraq and Afghanistan. Highly illegal. Also, in the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, which the United States has militarily occupied most of that land for 60 years, the U.S. Navy practiced with Agent Orange. And Agent Orange we used in Vietnam. Agent Orange contains dioxin, the most dangerous chemical known to science. And still, Vietnamese people are being born with birth defects from exposure of their ancestors to Agent Orange. U.S. veterans are still dying of diseases related to Agent Orange. And yet in Vieques, we used Agent Orange, napalm, uranium. We used napalm in Vietnam. There's that iconic photo of the young girl naked running from having just been covered with napalm, which was manufactured by Dow Chemical, which melts the skin. It burns the skin. And so when you think about the hypocrisy involved of the United States, I should say Obama, because Congress certainly has not supported what he's doing, and he doesn't even intend to go to Congress. And by the way, even if Congress did say okay, it would still be illegal as violative of the UN Charter and of customary international law. You cannot conduct an aggressive war in another country, and it's the highest form of customary international law. It's called jus cogens. It's a prohibition that's so strong that things like slavery and torture and wars of aggression cannot be mounted by people, even if they even if they haven't signed treaties outlawing those things, because the entire world community has said they're absolutely unacceptable. So it would just for so many reasons, this would be illegal. It would be hypocritical. It could lead to a widening of a regional war in the Middle East. It's opposed by most Americans. It's opposed by people in the Arab world. In the New York Times, they cited polls that show the vast majority of Arabs across the region view any action by the United States in particular as motivated by its own interest or Israel's, no matter the context, perhaps because of the history of colonialism. Mm-hmm. So there's no good that can come out of fanning the flames of a tinderbox of a civil war that is already... It's already tragic, and when John Kerry talks about moral obscenity, Hans Blix says with 100,000 killed and millions of refugees, the Civil War itself is a moral obscenity, but it's not for the U.S. to go in and do what it would really be a symbolic action, although it would kill a number of people, mm-hmm. Because they aren't trying to stop these chemical weapons. They're not going to be bombing chemical weapons factories. That would spread chemicals all over. It's not even clear what they would be bombing, except that the intent really would be to punish Assad, degrade Assad, because they see Syria as being aligned with Iran, and that Israel sees that as opposed to its own interests.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and we're talking about the U.S. hypocrisy in its build-up, its attempt, or its plans to wage yet another war or a warlike action against the Syrian government and the Syrian people. Marjorie, tell me this, you know, because this is something that David brought up, and I've been thinking about a lot, because Obama, even when he's caught up in this thing about, well, you're not going to get the UN, and he says, oh yeah, well, I won't get the UN. And that does raise questions to me about, you know, the question of the legality of it. But then they immediately began talking about this thing called the Kosovo precedent. And I think it's extremely important that people understand both that and this right to protect thing they did to justify Libya, the Kosovo precedent in relation to the bombing and breakup of Yugoslavia, and then this right to protect in the relation to the assault on Libya.
Yes, well, in the night before Clinton led the NATO bombing of Kosovo in 1999, Clinton said, and this is not widely known, but he said, we have to be able to sell to markets around the world. That's what this Kosovo thing is all about. And yet it was couched in terms of ethnic cleansing, the Serbs against the Albanians. But ethnic cleansing had been going on by both sides for centuries. And they never got, Clinton and his coalition never got the Security Council to agree, and it was not done in self-defense. Because Yugoslavia had not attacked the United States or any of the other countries that were invading. So they said, well, they used to call it humanitarian intervention, but humanitarian concerns don't constitute self-defense, and self-defense is the only exception to the UN Charter's prohibition on the use of force. If they really had humanitarian concerns, then the international community should seek peace and end the suffering, not increase military attacks and create more suffering. A concept of humanitarian intervention, which is not found in the UN Charter and is not international law, does not constitute international law, has morphed into this concept called responsibility to protect. Responsibility to protect is not found in any treaty. It's not a norm of international law, and yet it has appeared in General Assembly document, and some of the language of what they call R2P, responsibility to protect, has been in some Security Council resolutions. But again, it is not a norm of international law. And it basically says that a country has the responsibility to protect its own citizens against war crimes, genocide crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. But if it cannot or it does not protect its own citizens, then other countries have the responsibility to protect the citizens of other countries, even if they're not, even if it's not on their own territory. The problem with R2P, in addition to the fact that it is not an established norm of international law, it's not found in any treaty, is who decides? Who decides that a country needs protecting, that people need protecting? Well, probably the powerful countries, the ones who have the bombs, who can go in and use their humanitarian bombs to kill more people. But the small countries, what if they think that that there's a need to protect citizens of other countries? It's a slippery slope, and it's going to come down to the powerful countries, for geopolitical reasons, using military force, couched in the language of R2P, responsibility to protect. So this is, there are some people who are espousing it, although Obama hasn't said anything about it yet. I suspect, and I would predict that once he does go into Syria, he's going to start using the language of R2P, responsibility to protect. We haven't heard it yet. The language we've heard is retaliation, punishment of Assad for allegedly using nuclear weapons, which is highly illegal. Chemical weapons are illegal regardless of who uses them. They constitute war crimes. People who use them should be arrested and tried as war criminals. But certainly killing more people to stop killing is counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. And I understand Bush and Obama are going to be turning themselves in for having violated all those laws. Shortly after this interview is over, Marjorie, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Michael.
Sure.
Take care.
Okay, and look forward to talking to you again soon. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Marjorie Cohn, professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and we've been talking about the U.S. hypocrisy and the laws of war. And if you want to read Marjorie's article, you can go to consortiumnews.com and find her article there. It's a very, very good article, very much worth looking into. I also want to recommend that if people want to get a revolutionary analysis of what's going on in relation to this threatened attack on Syria, go to revcom.us, and the article is called Only Worse Suffering and Horrors Can Result from a U.S. Attack on Syria. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Marilyn McMahon from California Prison Focus about what's going on with the California prisoner hunger strike. So stay tuned.
Right to live when they sentence you to prison, feeling cold and empty, gutted like from an incision. Some fall back on religion, last refuge of a free faller, and you can't call her. So holler if you hear me through the cell walls, like being trapped in hell. I'm trying to tell y'all, when you lock men in cages, they can turn to animals, contagious. Dog eat dog, rabid cannibals. Start off from the bullpen where you'll spend many hours sleeping on the concrete floor and getting any shower. Stomach growling from the phony two-tone baloney that they feed you, leave you lonely in a room full of thousands. Pounding on the block with your head, wishing you dead instead of buried alive inside of a 9x10. Wishing you were kissing your children or with your girls.
All right, welcome back. Once again, that Sunrise Above with Incarceration, all right? Cat's got some very, very interesting music, and his name again is Sunrise Above. All right, the California prison hunger strike against the torture of indefinite solitary confinement is in its eighth week, and many, many, many prisoners continue to refuse food, and their conditions worsen. The state is threatening to impose further torture in the form of force feeding. They have already adopted a practice of retaliating against the hunger strikers, both at Pelican Bay and, according to recent reports, at Corcoran State Prison. Joining us to talk about all this is Marilyn McMahon. Marilyn's the executive director of California Prison Focus. She's an attorney. She's part of the mediation team in relation to the strike. And she's coming to talk to us about an update on the prisoner struggle and what's going on inside the walls. And we'll talk about what's going on outside the walls and needs to be going on outside the walls as well. Marilyn, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good
sure.
to be here, Michael.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it right away. Where do things stand overall? We're in the eighth week. This is kind of phenomenal. This is very heavy. 8 weeks that a number of people, a number of prisoners, significant number of prisoners have been going without eating. And where do things stand? What's overall happening?
Well, not a lot, unfortunately. It's amazing that there are, I believe, still dozens of prisoners who, as you say, are in their eighth week without food, and the Department of Corrections still is not sitting down and talking with them about their demands. The department still wants to put all the blame on the prisoners and not face the fact that the only reason they're on this peaceful protest is because the department can't manage to uphold constitutional standards in its prisons.
Well, you know, one of the things that I found very, very, very heavy in all this is that even as the strike is going on, and the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, it's doing what it's doing and it's saying what it's saying, but there's some really, really lethal and disgusting stuff. And really, I mean, stuff that should not escape anyone's attention. And first of all, and again, Beard being the head of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, that was just such a horrendous and just disgusting attack on the prisoners, meant to actually isolate the prisoners from the people, from support outside, but also to paint them in a very particular way that would justify the continuation of things like the SHU units and the long-term solitary confinement and all this. This was really, really an incredible piece. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I think disgust, certainly. And beyond that, it's like, oh, well, just the kind of propaganda you kind of expect from the department. But it's appalling that someone would write such a vitriolic piece against human beings who were starving at that very moment, when Beard himself is the person most in the position to solve the problem by granting the reasonable demands of the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
CDC officials have agreed, I have acknowledged on several occasions, that most of the demands are reasonable, and yet they won't grant them. So I'd like to ask Jeffrey Beard why that is and why he has to resort to that sort of piece instead of doing something constructive to remedy the situation.
Well, you know, one of the things that I read that was kind of surprising was that apparently the CDCR did, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation did, which is headed up by Jeffrey Beard, did actually they posted a response to the prisoners' demands recently on their website. What was that response? Do you know?
Yes. It was a blow-by-blow through the 40 supplemental demands that the prisoners had put out before this hunger strike. And they went through them all and pointed out the few that they've met and claim to have met many more that they have not by being less than truthful or just using some clever wording to make it sound like they'd really done something when they hadn't. So the mediation team has put out a response, and the prisoner representatives at Pelican Bay, I believe, have put out their own response. Trying to clear the factual record to correct it.
Well, what was that response? What do you mean, clear the factual record?
Well, let's see. I'm just looking at it right now to give you some examples. One of the demands was allow SHU inmates to have one weekly phone call. And for people who aren't aware of this, yes, men are in these units for more than 20 years, there are a couple who've been there over 40 years, and they don't get any phone calls. In special cases, maybe they get a phone call to a lawyer. They can't call their families. They never can talk to their families. So this demand was just give us some phone calls. And the department said, oh, we've done that, because in our new policy, in the fourth year, they get phone calls. In the first and second years, they get one phone call per year. So we've met the demand. Well, most people wouldn't think that one weekly phone call is the same as one annual phone call. So that is typical of the kind of thing. They also, the inmates had asked to be able to have televisions or radios in all of the administrative segregation units, which are in some respects worse than the SHUs, because the prisoners aren't allowed to even have TV or radio, and yet they can be kept in there for a couple years. So with nothing to listen to, no human voice, just nothing to watch for entertainment, if they don't happen to be readers, I don't know how they pass their time. It must be just horrible. So the prisoner said, you know, give everybody the opportunity to have a TV or radio. And the department said, well, this has already been addressed, but not all of these ADSEG units have electrical outlets. Well, one of the places where they're being told they can't have them because there are no electrical outlets is in Pelican Bay, where recently I think a plumber came in to fix something and opened up the wall, and lo and behold, behind there they can see electrical outlets. So the department, you know, is just, well, they didn't lie. They didn't say at Pelican Bay they have no electrical outlets. They just said they don't all have them, as though all the ones that have them, we allow the prisoners to have television or radio. Well, mm-hmm. That's just not true.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Marilyn McMahon from California Prison Focus about the California prisoner hunger strike. Well, there is a bizarre element in this where Beard has said, and the CDCR has put out almost as its official position, that, well, we don't really have solitary confinement in California. That's really a lie. It's like, I mean, this is the kind of thing that I think is just so outrageous. And, you know, people see that and they're, you know, it's like, what the hell are they talking about? No, we don't have it. And then at the same time, you have the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, what was his name, Mendez, speaking out and saying that the U.S. is, in fact, using solitary confinement and I got to have access to these prisons. They should stop using it and let me inspect these prisons. And they're just sort of stonewalling that as well.
That's right. I believe it's the U.S. government that's not giving. They have to invite him to inspect them, and they're withholding that. So we should all be talking to Eric Holder and telling him to issue that invitation. But the department wants to nitpick about terminology. Oh, this isn't solitary confinement. I like to call it isolation. Sure, call it isolation. Call it whatever you want. But the public knows what it is. It's what most people think of as solitary confinement. It's not the type where a person is miles away from any human being or something, but they're most of them alone in their cell, and some of them are double-celled. So they're in a space with another human being that's, you know, about the size of a closet, and they're within a few feet of the toilet when they eat, because they can't get further away from it, an open toilet, sharing it with another person, you know. So I don't think that having a celly really makes it a wonderful experience.
Right, yeah. Well, let me ask you this, Marilyn. Let me ask you this now, because we're running up on our time, and I want to make sure that we have a chance to talk about this. One of the most significant developments around this has been the court ruling, the federal judge that issued the ruling, the California state has it that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has the right to force feed prisoners as a response to the hunger strike. Let's talk about that, because that is a very heinous development.
Yeah, it's very upsetting. The most positive reading of it is that the judge actually said there are allegations that some prisoners have been coerced into hunger striking and even coerced into signing advance directives that say do not resuscitate, basically. And clearly, if that's true, that's very upsetting. I think we'd all agree that would be horrible for somebody to die because they were coerced by someone else. But somehow this order got issued without there being any evidence produced. You know, why is it the department doesn't have to produce something? They can make up anything and go to a judge. Unfortunately, they went there with the receiver's office and the prison law office behind them. So I think that's why the judge didn't question it, because the so-called prisoner's attorneys were there. And I believe everyone was motivated by believing the department's claim that some people were coerced. So there has since been some clarification or explanation released by the prison law office and the department saying they don't intend to do the nasal gastric tubes, if they can help it. I'm sure there was wiggle language in there.
Yeah, if they can help it would actually kind of indicate that.
That it won't be simply a matter of all advance directives are ignored and everybody will be resuscitated no matter what, but supposedly the physician will make an individualized determination in each case and, if possible, talk with each prisoner about what they want. And I understand that the receiver's office has been going around trying to talk to all the prisoners still on hunger strike who have advanced directives at any rate, to find out, to try to ascertain whether they were coerced or not. Mm-hmm. And that's all well and good. But there is this order allowing the department to force feed anybody and ignore the advance directive, and that is extremely disturbing.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Marilyn McMahon from California Prison Focus about the California prisoner hunger strike. I don't know if you saw Yasin Bey, Mos Def's video about what it's like to be force-fed, and he was doing that in relation to Guantanamo. And it actually is a form of torture, and when you look at it in this sense, it's torture being used to keep prisoners undergoing even further torture. They're torturing people for standing up against torture, which is at the heart of the strike, the hunger strike, in terms of, you know, stopping long-term solitary confinement. And the actual reality, the scientific reality, that long-term solitary confinement is, in fact, torture. So you look at this, and the Orwellian thing comes in, because what are they doing? They're calling it refeeding.
That's another obfuscation by the department and the receiver's office.
Yeah.
They don't want to tell the clear story because the clear story is so ugly, so they disguise it. But, yeah, that's absolutely right, and you express the irony really well that they're torturing them because the prisoners are protesting torture.
Mm-hmm. Other forms of retaliation against the prisoners, I understand there's been quite a bit of that as well.
There certainly has. They're being given disciplinary write-ups for peacefully protesting. They're having their TVs taken away. Many of them have been stripped of all their property and moved to other cells or even to other prisons. So they have nothing, literally, but the clothes they're wearing. They have no paper to write to anyone. They don't have their photos, their books, really anything. So what else? They've been threatened with having permanent removal of their property, that it would be thrown out or they could send it home, but that means they never get it back. There have been really disturbing reports about physical hassling of prisoners, if not outright abuse, and racial taunting and epithets. You name it, guards can be very imaginative, and there have been lots of kinds of retaliation. Some of the more upsetting is that some prisoners have been moved, and it seems like they're going to be permanently moved, so they probably made friendships, relationships with their neighbors where they were housed. Some of them were housed there for years, and now they're yanked away from that community and just sent wherever. Why? Because they sat in their cell and didn't eat.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was thinking about too is it's actually, has there been a focused effort on? I understand they also unleashed some retaliation specifically against the four people in the Short Carter in the Pelican Bay SHU. The Short Carter Collective being those prisoners who reside on the Short Carter of the Pelican Bay SHU unit, and these are the people who are the representatives of the prison hunger strikers. What's happened with them?
That's right. Well, they've been from the get-go in the ADSEG standalone unit, where they say it's extremely cold, and of course when you're not eating, you get cold anyway, and so to make these cells particularly cold, blast the air through the vents all the time, is harassment at least. And now the four reps have been isolated even further by having all the other hunger strikers removed from that unit where they were all together. So the reps are there by themselves, and my belief is that they have been actually moved to other cells, so they're further away from each other. They can't even talk to each other. So now they're most definitely in solitary confinement. They can't speak to anybody but a guard if they ever see one. And the most disturbing thing to me is that in this unit, they have told us, if you call for help, no one hears you.
Mm.
They can all yell and yell. No one hears you. You have to wait for someone to go by, a nurse or a guard, and this happens about every 3 to 4 hours.
All right, on that note,
on like day 54 of this hunger strike, right. I believe one of the Irish hunger strikers died at day 53, if I recall. They're definitely in this danger zone, and if they have a heart attack, 4 hours could go by before anybody notices.
Mm-hmm. All right, Marilyn, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Marilyn McMahon from California Prison Focus. All right. And as we move to the end of the show, there's a couple of quotes I want to read to you. And the first one is part of a letter that was written to the public by the Pelican Bay Short Quarter Collective. That's that, as you remember, I mentioned, that's the collective that's made up of the representatives of the prison hunger strike whose cells are on the short corridor of the Pelican Bay Shoe Unit. And one of the at the end of that letter, it says on Friday, August 16th, the CDCR transferred 51 people on hunger strike from the ADSEG unit down south to a medical facility in preparation for force feeding. This is where we will all be soon. Some of us are considering a challenge to such feeding. What's going on in this nation that it has come to such a point? The people have the power to change things now. Know this. Our spirit and resolve remain strong, and we know we can count on you all. Together, we are making it happen, not only for ourselves, but more importantly, for generations to come. And if you want to actually read a really great response to Jeffrey Beard's slanderous piece, go to revcom.us. You can read what is actually revealed in the California Prisoners' Hunger Strike, responding to Jeff Beard's Los Angeles op-ed. You can also there access a lot of different articles on the prison hunger strike. All right, and as we leave this segment, I want to read a quote from Bob Avakian that I think brings this whole the theme of today's show very much into focus, sets it up in the framework it needs to be set up in, something for everybody to think about before we get back together again next week. So here it is. The essence of what exists in the U.S. is not democracy, but capitalism, imperialism, and political structures to enforce that capitalism, imperialism. What the U.S. spreads around the world is not democracy, but imperialism and political structures to enforce that imperialism. That's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and you can find that in his book, Basics. All right, and as we go out, I want to thank all of my guests today, David Swanson, Marjorie Cohn, and Marilyn McMahon. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my production assistant, intern, Jeffrey Pryor. And as I said, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. You want to follow me, you can do it, but quietly and not in a creepy way through Facebook and Twitter. We're going to go out now with Michael Franti and Bomb the World.
I don't understand the whole reason why you're telling us all that we need to unify. Rally round the flag and beat the drums of war. Sing the same old songs, we heard them all before. You're telling me it's unpatriotic, but I call it when I see it. When I see it's idiotic. The tears of one mother are the same as any other. Drop food on your kids while you're murdering the fathers. But don't bother to show it on CNN. Brothers and sisters, don't believe them that it's a war against evil. It's really just revenge engaged on the poorest by the same rich men. Fight terrorists wherever they be found. But why you not bombing Tim McVeigh's hometown? You can say what you want, propaganda television, but all bombing is terrorism. Chase down